testimony against Bukharin and Rykov, both of whom were sitting right there among the leaders. Or Jonikidze put his hand up to his ear. He was hard of hearing. "See here, are you giving all this testimony voluntarily?" "Note that down, or Jonikidze will get a bullet of his own." "Absolutely voluntarily," and Pyatakov swayed on his feet. And during the recess, Rykov said to Bukharin, "Tomsky had willpower. He understood it all back in August, and he ended his own life, while you and I, like fools, have gone on living." At this point, Kaganovich made an angry, condemnatory speech. He wanted so much to believe in Bukharchik's innocence, but he couldn't any longer. And then Molotov. And then Stalin. What a generous heart. What a memory for the good things. "Nonetheless, I consider that Bukharin's guilt has not yet been proven. Perhaps Rykov is guilty, but not Bukharin." Someone had drawn up charges against Bukharin, against his will. From cold to hot. That's how willpower collapses. That's how to grow used to the role of a ruined hero. And then they began to bring to his home, day after day, the records of interrogations, the depositions of young ex-students in the Institute of Red Professors, of Radek, and all the rest of them. And they all provided the gravest proofs of Bukharin's black treason. They took these documents to his home, not as if he were a defendant, oh, by no means, merely in his position as a member of the Central Committee, merely for his information. Usually, when he received a new batch of these materials, Bukharin would say to his 22-year-old wife, who only that spring had given him a son, "You read them, I can't," and he would bury his head in his pillow. He had two revolvers at home. Stalin was giving him time, too. And yet he did not commit suicide. Is it not clear that he had grown used to his ordained role? And one more public trial took place, and they shot one more batch of defendants. And yet they continued to be merciful to Bukharin. They had not taken Bukharin. At the beginning of February 1937, he decided to go on a hunger strike at home in order to force the Central Committee to hold a hearing and clear him of the charges against him. He announced it in a letter to Dear Koba, and he honestly went through with it, too. Then a plenum of the Central Committee was convened with the following agenda. 1. The crimes of the rightist centre. 2. The anti-party conduct of Comrade Bukharin, as evidenced by his hunger strike. Bukharin hesitated. Had he perhaps really insulted the party in some particular way? Unshaven, thin, wan, already a prisoner in appearance, he dragged himself along to the plenum. "What on earth were you thinking of?" Dear Koba asked him cordially. "But what was I to do in the face of such accusations? They want to expel me from the party." Stalin made a wry face at the absurdity. "Come on now, no one is going to expel you from the party." Bukharin believed him and revived. He willingly assured the plenum of his repentance and immediately abandoned his hunger strike. At home, he said, "Come on now, cut me some sausage. Koba said they wouldn't expel me." But in the course of the plenum, Kaganovich and Molotov, impudent fellows they were indeed, paid no attention to Stalin's opinion. See what a wealth of information we are deprived of because we're protecting Molotov's noble old age. Both called Bukharin a fascist hireling and demanded that he be shot. And once again Bukharin's spirits fell, and in his last days he began to compose his Letter to the Future Central Committee. Committed to memory and thereby preserved, it recently became known to the whole world. However, it did not shake the world to its foundations, nor did it shake the future Central Committee either. For what were the last words this brilliant theoretician decided to hand down to future generations? Just one more cry of anguish and a plea to be restored to the party. He paid dearly in shame for that devotion. And one more affirmation that he fully approved everything that had happened up to and including 1937, and that included not only all the previous jeeringly mocking trials, but also all the foul-smelling waves of our great prison sewage disposal system. And that is how he himself certified that he, too, deserved to plunge into those waves. So, at long last, he had matured to the point of being turned over to the prompters and the assistant producers, this muscular man, this hunter and wrestler. In playful tussles in the presence of the Central Committee, how many times had he landed Stalin flat on his back? And this, too, was probably something Koba couldn't forgive him. And in the case of one so fully prepared, so demolished that no torture was called for, how was his position any stronger than that of Yakubovich in 1931? How could he not be susceptible to the same two arguments? He was, in fact, much weaker, because Yakubovich longed for death, and Bukharin dreaded it. There remained an easy dialogue with Vyshinsky along set lines. Is it true that every opposition to the party is a struggle against the party? In general, it is, factually it is. But a struggle against the party cannot help but grow into a war against the party. According to the logic of things, yes, it must. And that means that in the end, given the existence of oppositionist beliefs, any foul deeds whatever might be perpetrated against the party. Espionage, murder, sellout of the motherland. But wait a minute, none were actually committed. But they could have been, well, theoretically speaking, those are your theoreticians for you. But for us, the highest of all interests are those of the party. Yes, of course, of course. So, you see, only a very fine distinction separates us. We are required to concretize the eventuality. In the interest of discrediting for the future any idea of opposition, we are required to accept as having taken place what could only theoretically have taken place. After all, it could have, couldn't it? It could have. And so it is necessary to recognize as actual what was possible. That's all. It's a small philosophical transition. Are we in agreement? Yes, and one thing more. And it's not for me to explain to you, but if you retreat and say something different during the trial, you understand that it will only play into the hands of the world bourgeoisie and will only do the party harm. Well, and it's clear that in that case you yourself will not die an easy death. But if everything goes off all right, we will, of course, allow you to go on living. We'll send you in secret to the island of Monte Cristo, and you can work on the economics of socialism there. But in previous trials, as I understand it, you did shoot them all. But what comparison is there between you and them? And then we also left many of them alive, too. They were shot only in the newspapers. And so, perhaps, there isn't any insoluble riddle. It was all that same invincible theme song, persisting with only minor variations through so many different trials. After all, we and you are communists. How could you have gotten off the track and come out against us? Repent! After all, you and we together is us. Historical comprehension ripens slowly in a society, and when it does ripen, it is so simple. Neither in 1922, nor in 1924, nor in 1937, were the defendants able to hang on to their own point of view so firmly that they could raise their heads and shout, in reply to that bewitching and anaesthetizing melody, "No, we are not revolutionaries with you. No, we are not Russians with you. No, we are not communists with you." It would seem that if only that kind of shout had been raised, all the stage sets would have collapsed, the plaster masks would have fallen off, the producer would have fled down the back stairs, and the prompters would have sneaked off into their rat holes. And out of doors it would have been, say, 1967. But even the most superbly successful of these theatrical productions was expensive and troublesome, and Stalin decided not to use open trials any longer. Or, rather, in 1937, he probably did have a plan for holding public trials on a wide scale in the local districts, so the black soul of the opposition would be made visible to the masses. but he couldn't find producers who were good enough. It wasn't practical to prepare things so carefully, and the mental processes of the accused weren't so complex, and Stalin only got into a mess, although very few people know about it. The whole plan broke down after a few trials and was abandoned. It's appropriate here to describe one such trial, the Kadi case, detailed reports of which the Ivanovo provincial newspapers published initially. At the end of 1934, a new local administrative district was created in the remote wilds of Ivanovo province at the point where it joined Kostroma and Nizhny Novgorod provinces, and its center was situated in the ancient slow-moving village of Kadi. New leaders were sent there from various localities, and they made one another's acquaintance right in Kadi. There they found a remote, sad, impoverished region, badly in need of money, machines, and intelligent economic management, but instead starved by grain procurements. It happened that Fyodor Ivanovich Smirnov, the first secretary of the district party committee, was a man with a strong sense of justice. Stavrov, the head of the district agricultural department, was a peasant through and through, one of those peasants known as the intensivniki, in other words, the hard-working, zealous, and literate peasants who in the 20s had run their farms on a scientific basis, for which they were at that time rewarded by the Soviet government, since it had not yet been decided that all these intensivniki must be destroyed. Because Stavrov had entered the party, he had survived the liquidation of the kulaks, and maybe he even took part in the liquidation of the kulaks. These men tried to do something for the peasants in their new district, but directives kept pouring down from above, and each one ran counter to some initiative of theirs. It was as if, up there, they were busy thinking up what they could do to make things worse and more desperate for the peasants. And at one point, the leaders in Kadi wrote to the province leadership that it was necessary to lower the plan for procurement of bread grains, because the district couldn't fulfill the plan without becoming impoverished well below the danger point. One has to recall the situation in the 30s, and maybe not only the 30s, to realize what sacrilege against the plan and what rebellion against the government this represented. But in accordance with then current style, measures were not taken directly from above, but were left to local initiative. When Smirnov was on vacation, his deputy, Vasily Fyodorovich Romanov, the second secretary, arranged to have a resolution passed by the district party committee. The successes of the district would have been even more brilliant if it were not for the Trotskyite Stavrov. This set in motion the individual case of Stavrov. An interesting approach, divide and rule. For the time being, Smirnov was merely to be frightened, neutralized, and compelled to retreat. There would be time enough later on to get to him. And this, on a small scale, was precisely the Stalinist tactic in the Central Committee. At stormy party meetings, however, it became clear that Stavrov was about as much of a Trotskyite as he was a Jesuit. The head of the district consumer cooperatives, Vasily Grigorievich Vlasov, a man with a ragtag, haphazard education, but one of those native talents others are so surprised to find among Russians, a born retail trade executive, eloquent, adroit in an argument, who could get fired to red heat about anything he believed to be right, tried to persuade the party meeting to expel Romanov from the party for slander. And they actually did give Romanov an official party rebuke. Romanov's last words in this dispute were typical of this kind of person, demonstrating his assurance in regard to the general situation. Even though they proved Stavrov was not a Trotskyite, nonetheless I am sure he is a Trotskyite. The party will investigate, and it will also investigate the rebuke to me. And the party did investigate. The district NKVD arrested Stavrov almost immediately, and 1 month later they also arrested Univer, the chairman of the district executive committee, and an Estonian. And Romanov took over Univer's job as chairman of the district executive committee. Stavrov was taken to the provincial NKVD, where he confessed he was a Trotskyite, that he had acted in coalition with the SRs all his life, that he was a member of an underground rightist organization in his district. This is a bouquet worthy of the times, the only thing missing being a connection with the Entente. Perhaps he never really did confess these things, but no one is ever going to know, since he died from torture during interrogation in the internal prison of the Ivanovo NKVD. The pages of his deposition were there in full. Soon afterward, they arrested Smirnov, the secretary of the District Party Committee, as the head of the supposed rightist organization, and Savarov, the head of the District Financial Department, and someone else as well. Of interest is the way in which Vlasov's fate was decided. He had only recently demanded the expulsion from the party of Romanov, now the new chairman of the District Executive Committee. He had also fatally offended Russov, the district prosecutor, as we have already reported in Chapter 4 above. He had offended N.I. Krylov, the chairman of the district NKVD, by protecting two of his energetic and resourceful executives from being arrested for supposed wrecking. Both of them had black marks on their records because of their social origins. Vlasov always hired all kinds of former people for his work, because they mastered the business effectively and, in addition, tried hard. People promoted from the ranks of the proletariat knew nothing and, more importantly, didn't want to know anything. Nonetheless, the NKVD was prepared to make its peace with the trade cooperative. Sorokin, the deputy chairman of the district NKVD, came in person to see Vlasov with a peace proposal. To give the NKVD 700 rubles worth of materials without charging them for it, and later on we will somehow write it off, the rag pickers, and that was 2 months' wages for Vlasov, who had never taken anything illegally for himself. "And if you don't give it to us, you are going to regret it." Vlasov kicked him out. "How do you dare offer me, a communist, a deal like that?" The very next day, Krylov paid a call on the District Consumer Cooperative, this time as the representative of the District Committee of the Party. This masquerade, like all these tricks, was in the spirit of 1937. And this time he ordered the convening of a party meeting. The agenda? On the wrecking activities of Smirnov and Univer in the Consumers' Cooperatives. The report to be delivered by Comrade Vlasov. Well, now that's a gem of a trick for you. No one at that point was making charges against Vlasov, but it would be quite enough for him to say two little words about the wrecking activities of the former secretary of the District Party Committee in his, Vlasov's, field, and the NKVD would interrupt, "And where were you? Why didn't you come to us in time?" In a situation of this sort, many others would have lost their heads and allowed themselves to be trapped, but not Vlasov. He immediately replied, "I won't make the report. Let Krylov make the report. After all, he arrested Smirnov and Univer and is handling their case." Krylov refused. "I'm not familiar with the evidence." Vlasov replied, "If even you aren't familiar with the evidence, that means they were arrested without cause." So the party meeting simply didn't take place. But how often did people dare to defend themselves? We will not have a complete picture of the atmosphere of 1937 if we lose sight of the fact that there were still strong-willed people capable of difficult decisions, and if we fail to recall that late that night T, the senior bookkeeper of the District Consumer Cooperative, and his deputy N came to Vlasov's office with 10,000 rubles. "Vasily Grigorievich, get out of town tonight. Don't wait for tomorrow, otherwise you are finished." But Vlasov thought it did not befit a communist to run away. The next morning, there was a nasty article in the district paper on the work of the District Consumer Cooperative. One has to point out that in 1937 the press always played hand in glove with the NKVD. By evening, Vlasov had been asked to give the District Party Committee an accounting of his own work. Every step of the way, this was how things were in the entire Soviet Union. This was 1937, the second year of the so-called Mikoyan prosperity in Moscow and other big cities. And even today, in the reminiscences of journalists and writers, one gets the impression that at the time there was already plenty of everything. This concept seems to have gone down in history, and there is a danger of it staying there. And yet, in November 1936, 2 years after the abolition of bread rationing, a secret directive was published in Ivanovo province and in other provinces, prohibiting the sale of flour. In those years, many housewives in small towns, and particularly in villages, still used to bake their own bread. Prohibiting the sale of flour meant, do not eat bread. In the district centre of Kadi, long bread lines formed such as had never before been seen. However, they attacked that problem too, by forbidding the baking of black bread in district centres, permitting only expensive white bread to be baked. The only bakery in the whole Kadi district was the one in the district centre, and people began to pour into the centre from the villages to get black bread. The warehouses of the district consumer cooperative had flour, but the two parallel prohibitions blocked off all avenues by which it could be made available to the public. Vlasov, however, managed to find a way out of the impasse, and despite the clever government rulings, he kept the district fed for a whole year. He went out to the collective farms and got 8 of them to agree to set up public bakeries in empty kulak huts. In other words, they would simply bring in firewood and set the women to baking in ordinary Russian peasant ovens, but mind you, ovens which were now socialized, publicly, not privately owned. The district consumer cooperative would undertake to supply them with flour. There is eternal simplicity to a solution once it has been discovered. Without building any bakeries, for which he had no funds, Vlasov set them up in one day. Without carrying on a trade in flour, he released flour from the warehouse continuously and proceeded to order more from the provincial centre. Without selling black bread in the district centre, he gave the district black bread. Yes, he did not violate the letter of the instructions, but he violated their spirit. For their essence was to compel a reduction in flour consumption by starving the people. And so, of course, there were good grounds for criticizing him at the district party committee. After that criticism, he remained free overnight and was arrested the next morning. He was a tough little bantam rooster. He was short and he always carried his head slightly thrown back, with a touch of aggressiveness. He tried to avoid surrendering his party membership card, because no decision expelling him from the party had been reached at the district party committee the night before. He also refused to give up his identification card as a deputy of the district Soviet, since he had been elected by the people, and the district executive committee had not taken any decision depriving him of his deputy's immunity. But the police did not appreciate such formalities, and overpowered him, and took them away by main force. They took him from the district consumer cooperative down the main street of Kadi in broad daylight, and his young merchandise manager, a Komsomol member, saw him from the window of the district party committee headquarters. At that time, not everyone, especially in the villages, because of the naivety, had learned to keep quiet about what they thought. The merchandise manager shouted, "Look at those bastards! Now they've taken away my boss, too!" Right then and there, without leaving the room, they expelled him from both the district party committee and from the Komsomol, and he slid down the well-known pathway into the bottomless pit. Vlasov was arrested very late in comparison with the others who were charged in the same case. The case had been nearly completed without him, and it was in process of being set up as an open trial. They took him to the Ivanovo NKVD internal prison, but since he was the last to be involved, he was not subjected to any heavy pressure. He was interrogated twice, there was no supporting testimony from witnesses, and the file of his interrogation was filled with summary reports of the district consumer cooperative and clips from the district newspaper. Vlasov was charged with 1. Initiating bread lines, 2. Having an inadequate minimum assortment of merchandise, just as though the unavailable merchandise existed somewhere else and someone had offered it to Kadi. 3. Procuring a surplus of salt. But this was the obligatory mobilization reserve. Ever since ancient times, people in Russia have been afraid of being without salt in the event of war. At the end of September, the defendants were brought to Kadi for public trial. It was not a short trip. Remember how cheap the OSOs and the closed courts were. From Ivanovo to Kineshma, they went in a Stolypin railway car. Then 70 miles from Kineshma to Kadi in automobiles. There were more than 10 cars, an unusual file along an old, deserted road, and one that aroused astonishment, fear, and the expectation of war in the villages. Klyugin, the chief of the Special Secret Department of the Provincial NKVD for Counter-Revolutionary Organizations, was responsible for the faultless organization of the whole trial, and for terrifying the public with it. Their convoy consisted of 40 guards from the reserves of the mounted police, and every day from September the 24th to the 27th, with swords unsheathed and Naguan revolvers at the ready, they took the prisoners from the district NKVD to the still unfinished club building and back, through the village where they had until recently been the government. Windows had already been installed in the club, but the stage had not yet been finished. There was no electricity. There was no electricity in Kadi at all. After nightfall, the court met by the light of kerosene lamps. The spectators were brought in from the collective farms in rotation, and all Kadi crowded in as well. Not only did they sit on windowsills and benches, but they stood packed in the aisles, 700 of them at a time. Russians have always loved spectacles. The forward benches were regularly reserved for communists to provide the court with dependable support. A special assize of the provincial court had been constituted, consisting of deputy chairman of the provincial court Shubin, who presided, and members Bicher and Zaodzerov. The provincial prosecutor Karasik, a graduate of Dorpat University, was in charge of the prosecution. And even though all the accused declined defense lawyers, a government lawyer was forced on them so that the case wouldn't be left without a prosecutor. The formal indictment, solemn, menacing, and lengthy, came down in essence to the charge that an underground rightist Bukharinite group had existed in Kadi district, which had been formed in Ivanovo, in other words, you could expect arrests in Ivanovo too, and had as its purpose the overthrow by wrecking of the Soviet government in the village of Kadi. And this was about the remotest boondock in all Russia the rightists could have found for a starting point. The prosecutor petitioned the court to have Stavrov's testimony, given before his death in prison, read to the court and accepted as evidence. In fact, the whole charge against the group was based on Stavrov's evidence. The court agreed to include the testimony of the deceased, just as if he were alive, with the advantage, however, that none of the defendants could refute it. But darkest Kadi did not appreciate these scholarly fine points. It waited to see what came next. The testimony of Stavrov, who had been killed under interrogation, was read to the court and once again became part of the record. The questioning of the defendants began, and immediately there was chaos. All of them repudiated the testimony they had given during the interrogation. It is not clear how, in such an event, things would have been arranged in the October Hall of the House of the Unions in Moscow, but here at any rate it was decided shamelessly to continue. The judge rebuked the defendants. How could you have given different testimony during the interrogation? Univer, very weak, replied in a barely audible voice, As a communist, I cannot, in a public trial, describe the interrogation methods of the NKVD. Now there was a model for the Bukharin trial. Now that's what keeps them together. More than anything else, they are worried that people might think ill of the party. Their judges had long since stopped worrying about that. During the recess, Klyugin visited the cells of the defendants. He said to Vlasov, You've heard how Smirnov and Univer played the whore, the bastards. You've got to admit your guilt and tell the whole truth. The truth and nothing but the truth, willingly agreed Vlasov, who had not yet weakened. The truth and nothing but the truth, that you are every bit as bad as the German fascists. Klyugin flew into a rage. Listen here, you whore, you'll pay with your blood. Your own blood, too, is going to flow soon, Klyugin. Caught in the Yezhov gang of Gebisti, Klyugin will have his throat cut by the stool pigeon Gubaidulin. From that moment, Vlasov was pushed forward from a back seat among the defendants to a leading role in the trial as the ideological leader of the group. The crowd jamming the aisles grew interested whenever the court fearlessly broke into questions about bread lines, about things that touched everyone present to the quick. And, of course, bread had been put on unrestricted sale just before the trial, and there were no bread lines that day. A question to the accused Smirnov. Did you know about the bread lines in the district? Yes, of course. They stretched from the store itself right up to the building of the district party committee. And what did you do about them? Notwithstanding the tortures he had endured, Smirnov had preserved his resounding voice and tranquil righteousness. This broad-shouldered man with a simple face and light brown hair answered slowly, and the whole hall heard every word he said. Since all appeals to organizations in the provincial capital had failed, I instructed Vlasov to write a report to Comrade Stalin. And why didn't you write it? They hadn't yet known about it. They had certainly missed that one. We did write it, and I sent it by courier directly to the Central Committee, bypassing the provincial leaders. A copy was kept in the district committee files. The whole courtroom held its breath. The court itself was in a commotion. They shouldn't have continued questioning, but nonetheless someone asked, "And what happened?" And indeed, that question was on the lips of everyone in the courtroom. What happened? Smirnov did not sob, did not groan over the death of his ideal, and that's what was missing in the Moscow trials. He replied loudly and calmly, "Nothing. There was no answer." And his tired voice seemed to say, "Well, that, in fact, was just what I expected." There was no answer. From the father and teacher, there was no answer. The public trial had already reached its zenith. It had already shown the masses the black heart of the cannibal, and the trial could have been called off right then and there. But, oh no, they didn't have sense enough for that, or tact enough for that, and they kept rubbing away at the befouled spot for 3 more days. The prosecutor raised a hue and cry. Double dealing, that's what it was. They engaged in wrecking with one hand, and with the other they dared write Comrade Stalin. And they even expected a reply from him. Let the defendant Vlasov tell us how he pulled off such a nightmarish piece of wrecking that he stopped the sale of flour and the baking of rye bread in the district centre. Vlasov, the bantam rooster, didn't have to be asked to rise. He had already jumped up, and he shouted resoundingly through the hall, "I agree to give a full answer to the court, but on condition that you, the prosecutor, Karasik, leave the accuser's rostrum and sit down here next to me." It was incomprehensible. Noise, shouting, call them to order. What was going on? Having gotten the floor with this maneuver, Vlasov explained willingly. The prohibitions on selling flour and baking rye bread were instituted by a decree of the Provincial Executive Committee. One of the permanent members of its presidium is Provincial Prosecutor Karasik. If that's wrecking, then why didn't you veto it as prosecutor? That means you were a wrecker even before I was. The prosecutor choked. It was a swift, well-placed blow. The court was also at a loss. The judge mumbled. If necessary, we will try the prosecutor too, but today we are trying you. Two truths. It all depends on your rank. I demand that he be removed from the prosecutor's rostrum, insisted the indefatigable, irrepressible Vlasov. Recess. Now, in terms of indoctrinating the masses, just what significance could such a trial have? But they kept on and on. After questioning the defendants, they began to question the witnesses. The bookkeeper, N. What do you know about Vlasov's wrecking activities?
Nothing.
How can that be? I was in the witnesses' room and I didn't hear what was said in here. You don't have to hear many documents pass through your hands. You couldn't help but know. The documents were all in proper order. But here is a stack of district newspapers, and even there they were writing about Vlasov's wrecking activities, and you claim you don't know anything? Well, go ask the people who wrote the articles. Then there was the manager of the bread store. Tell me, does the Soviet government have much bread? Well now, just how could you answer that? Who was going to say, I didn't count it? A lot. Why are there bread lines at your store? I don't know. Who was in charge? I don't know. What do you mean you don't know? Who was in charge of your store? Vasily Grigorievich. What the devil? What do you mean, calling him Vasily Grigorievich? Defendant Vlasov? That means he was in charge. The witness fell silent. The judge of the court dictated to the stenographer, The answer, as a consequence of the wrecking activity of Vlasov, bread lines resulted, notwithstanding the Soviet government's enormous stocks of bread. Repressing his own fears, the prosecutor delivered a long and angry speech. The defense lawyer, for the most part, defended only himself, emphasizing that the interests of the motherland were as dear to him as they were to any honest citizen. In his final words to the court, Smirnov asked for nothing and expressed no repentance for anything. Insofar as we can reconstruct it now, he was a firm person and too forthright to have lasted through 1937. When Saburov begged that his life be spared, "Not for me, but for my little children," Vlasov, out of vexation, pulled him back by the jacket. "You're a fool!" Vlasov himself did not fail to take advantage of his last chance to talk back impudently. "I consider you not a court, but actors pretending to be a court in a stage farce where roles have already been written for you. You are engaged in a repulsive provocation on the part of the NKVD. You are going to sentence me to be shot, no matter what I say. I believe one thing only. The time will come when you will be here in my place." Generally speaking, he was wrong just on this one point. The court spent from 7 p.m. to 1 a.m. composing the verdict, and all the while the kerosene lamps were burning in the hall, and the defendant sat beneath drawn sabers, and there was a hum of conversation among the spectators who had not left. And just as it took them a long time to compose the verdict, it took them a long time to read it, piling up on top of one another all kinds of fantastic wrecking activities, contacts, and plans. Smirnov, Univer, Saburov, and Vlasov were sentenced to be shot. Two others to 10 years, one to 8 years. In addition, the verdict of the court led to the exposure of an additional wrecking organization in the Komsomol in Kadi, whose members were, of course, immediately arrested. Remember the young merchandise manager? And of a center of underground organizations in Ivanovo, which was, of course, in its turn subordinate to Moscow. One more nail in Bukharin's coffin. After the solemn words, "to be shot," the judges paused for applause, but the mood in the hall was so gloomy with the sighs and tears of people who had no connection with the defendants and the screams and swooning of their relatives that no applause was to be heard even from the first two benches where the party members were sitting. This, indeed, was totally improper. "Oh, good Lord, what have you done?" someone in the hall shouted at the members of the court. Univer's wife dissolved in tears. In the half-darkness, the crowd began to stir. Vlasov shouted at the front benches, "Come on, you bastards! Why aren't you clapping? Some communists you are!" The political commissar of the guard's platoon ran up to him and shoved his revolver in his face. Vlasov reached out to grab the revolver, but a policeman ran up and pushed back his political commissar, who had been guilty of a blunder. The chief of the convoy gave the command, "Arms at the ready!" And 30 police carbines and the pistols of the local NKVD men were aimed at the defendants and at the crowd. It seemed at the time as though the crowd would rush forward to free the defendants. The hall was lit only by a few kerosene lamps, and the semi-darkness heightened the general confusion and fear. The crowd, finally convinced not so much by the trial as by the carbines now levelled at it, pushed in a panic against the doors and windows. The wood cracked and broke, glass tinkled. Univer's wife, in a dead faint, was almost trampled to death and was left lying beneath the chairs until morning. And there never was any applause. One little note on 8-year-old Zoya Vlasova. She loved her father intensely. She could no longer go to school. They teased her, "Your papa is a wrecker." She would get in a fight. "My papa is good." She lived only 1 year after the trial. Up to then, she had never been ill. During that year, she did not once smile. She went about with head hung low, and the old women prophesied, "She keeps looking at the earth. She is going to die soon." She died of inflammation of the brain, and as she was dying, she kept calling out, "Where is my papa? Give me my papa." When we count up the millions of those who perished in the camps, we forget to multiply them by 2, by 3. And not only couldn't the condemned prisoners be shot then and there, but they had to be kept under even stricter guard, because now they really had nothing at all to lose, and they had to be taken to the provincial capital for execution. They managed to cope with the first problem, sending them off by night to the NKVD along the main street, by having each condemned man guarded by 5 men. One of the guards carried a lantern. One went ahead with a pistol at the ready. 2 held the condemned prisoner by the arms and kept their pistols in their free hands. The 5th brought up the rear, with his pistol pointed at the condemned man's back. The rest of the police were ranged in formation in order to prevent any attack by the crowd. Every reasonable man will now agree that the NKVD could never have carried out its great assignment if they had fussed about with open trials, and that is why public political trials never really put down roots in our country. Chapter 11. The Supreme Measure. Capital punishment has had an up-and-down history in Russia. In the code of the Tsar Alexei Mikhailovich Romanov, there were 50 crimes for which capital punishment could be imposed. By the time of the military statutes of Peter the Great, there were 200. Yet the Empress Elizabeth, while she did not repeal those laws authorizing capital punishment, never once resorted to it. They say that when she ascended the throne, she swore an oath never to execute anyone, and for all 20 years of her reign she kept that oath. She fought the 7 Years' War, yet she still got along without capital punishment. It was an astounding record in the mid-18th century, 50 years before the guillotine of the Jacobins. True, we have taught ourselves to ridicule all our past. We never acknowledge a good deed or a good intention in our history. And one can very easily blacken Elizabeth's reputation, too. She replaced capital punishment with flogging with the knout, tearing out nostrils, branding with the word thief, and eternal exile in Siberia. But let us also say something on behalf of the Empress. How could she have changed things more radically than she did in contravention of the social concepts of her time? And perhaps the prisoner condemned to death today would voluntarily consent to that whole complex of punishments if only the sun would continue to shine on him. But we, in our humanitarianism, don't offer him that chance. And perhaps the reader will come to feel in the course of this book that 20 or even 10 years in our camps are harder to bear than were the punishments of Elizabeth. In today's terms, Elizabeth had a universally human point of view on all this, while the Empress Catherine the Great had, on the contrary, a class point of view, which was consequently more correct. Not to execute anyone at all seemed to her appalling and indefensible. She found capital punishment entirely appropriate to defending herself, her throne, and her system. In other words, in political cases such as those of Mirovich, the Moscow Plague Mutiny, and Pugachev. But for habitual criminals, for non-political offenders, why not consider capital punishment abolished? Under Paul, the abolition of capital punishment was confirmed. Despite his many wars, there were no military tribunals attached to military units. And during the whole long reign of Alexander I, capital punishment was introduced only for war crimes that took place during a campaign, 1812. Right at this point, some people will say to us, what about deaths from running the gauntlet? Yes, indeed, there were, of course, hidden executions. For that matter, one can literally drive a person to death with a trade union meeting. But the yielding up of one's God-given life because others, sitting in judgment, have so voted simply did not take place in our country, even for crimes of state, for an entire half-century, from Pugachev to the Decembrists. The blood of the five Decembrists whetted the appetite of our state. From then on, execution for crimes of state was no longer prohibited, nor was it forgotten, right up to the February Revolution in 1917. It was confirmed by the statutes of 1845 and 1904, and further reinforced by the criminal statutes of the army and navy. And how many people were executed in Russia during that period? We have already, in Chapter 8 above, cited the figures given by liberal leaders of 1905 to 1907. Let us add to them the verified figures of N.S. Tagantsev, the expert on Russian criminal law. Up until 1905, the death penalty was an exceptional measure in Russia. For a period of 30 years, from 1876 to 1904, the period of the Narodnaya Volya revolutionaries and the use of terrorism, a terrorism which did not consist merely of intentions murmured in the kitchen of a communal apartment, a period of mass strikes and peasant revolts, the period when the parties of the future revolution were created and grew in strength. 486 people were executed. In other words, about 17 people per year for the whole country. This figure includes executions of ordinary, non-political criminals. 13 people were executed in Schlüsselburg from 1884 to 1906, an awesome total for Switzerland, perhaps. During the years of the First Revolution, 1905, and its suppression, the number of executions rocketed upward, astounding Russian imaginations, calling forth tears from Tolstoy and indignation from Korolenko and many, many others. From 1905 through 1908, about 2,200 persons were executed, 45 a month. This, as Tagantsev said, was an epidemic of executions. It came to an abrupt end. When the provisional government came to power, it abolished capital punishment entirely. In July 1917, however, it was reinstated in the active army and frontline areas for military crimes, murder, rape, assault, and pillage, very widespread in those areas at that time. This was one of the most unpopular of the measures which destroyed the provisional government. The Bolshevik slogan before the Bolshevik coup d'etat was, "Down with capital punishment, reinstated by Kerensky." A story has come down to us that on the night of October the 25th to 26th, a discussion arose in Smolny as to whether one of the first decrees shouldn't be the abolition of capital punishment in perpetuity, whereupon Lenin justly ridiculed the idealism of his comrades. He, at any rate, knew that without capital punishment there would be no movement whatever in the direction of the new society. However, in forming a coalition government with the left SRs, he gave in to their faulty concepts, and on October the 28th, 1917, capital punishment was abolished. Nothing good, of course, could come from that goody-goody position. Yes, and how did they get rid of it? At the beginning of 1918, Trotsky ordered that Alexei Shastny, a newly appointed admiral, be brought to trial because he had refused to scuttle the Baltic fleet. Karklin, the chairman of the Vertrib, quickly sentenced him in broken Russian, "to be shot within 24 hours." There was a stir in the hall. "But it has been abolished," Prosecutor Krylenko explained. "What are you worrying about? Executions have been abolished. But Shchastny is not being executed. He is being shot." And they did shoot him. If we are to judge by official documents, capital punishment was restored in all its force in June 1918. No, it was not restored. Instead, a new era of executions was inaugurated. If one takes the view that Latsis is not deliberately understating the real figures, but simply lacks complete information, and that the Rev tribunals carried on approximately the same amount of judicial work as the Cheka performed in an extrajudicial way, one concludes that in the 20 central provinces of Russia in a period of 16 months, June 1918 to October 1919, more than 16,000 persons were shot, which is to say, more than 1,000 a month. Now that we have started to make comparisons, here is another. During the 80 years of the Inquisition's peak effort, 1420 to 1498, in all of Spain, 10,000 persons were condemned to be burned to death at the stake. In other words, about 10 a month. This, incidentally, is when they shot both Krustalev Nosar, the chairman of the 1905 St. Petersburg Soviet, the first Russian Soviet, and the artist who designed the legendary uniform worn by the Red Army throughout the Civil War. However, it may not even have been these individual executions, with or without formally pronounced death sentences, which added up to thousands and inaugurated the new era of executions in 1918 that stunned and froze Russia. Still more terrible to us was the practice, initially followed by both warring sides and later by the victors only, of sinking barges loaded with uncounted, unregistered hundreds, unidentified even by a roll call. Naval officers in the Gulf of Finland, in the White, Caspian and Black Seas, and as late as 1920, hostages in Lake Baikal. This is outside the scope of our narrow history of courts and trials, but it belongs to the history of morals, which is where everything else originates as well. In all our centuries, from the first Ryurik on, had there ever been a period of such cruelties and so much killing as during the post-October Civil War? We would omit from view one of the characteristic ups and downs of the Russian capital punishment story if we neglected to mention that capital punishment was abolished in January 1920. Yes, indeed. And some students of the subject might conceivably be at a loss to interpret the credulity and helplessness of a dictatorship that deprived itself of its avenging sword when Denikin was still in the Kuban, Wrangel still in the Crimea, and the Polish cavalry were saddling up for a campaign. But in the first place, this decree was quite sensible. It did not extend to the decisions of military tribunals, but applied only to extrajudicial actions of the Cheka and the decisions of tribunals in the rear. In the second place, the way was prepared for it by first cleaning out the prisons by the wholesale execution of prisoners who otherwise might have come under the decree. And in the third place, it was in effect for a brief period, 4 months. It lasted only until the prisons had filled up again. By a decree of May the 28th, 1920, capital punishment was restored to the Cheka. The revolution had hastened to rename everything so that everything would seem new. Thus, the death penalty was rechristened the supreme measure, no longer a punishment but a means of social defence. From the groundwork of the criminal legislation of 1924, it is clear that the supreme measure was introduced only temporarily, pending its total abolition by the All-Russian Central Executive Committee. And in 1927 they actually did begin to abolish it. It was retained solely for crimes against the state and the army, Article 58, and military crimes, and true for banditry also. But the broad political interpretation of banditry was as well known then as it is now, from a Central Asian basmach right up to a Lithuanian forest guerrilla. Every armed nationalist who doesn't agree with the central government is a bandit, and how could one possibly get along without that article? Similarly, any participant in a camp rebellion and any participant in an urban rebellion is also a bandit. But where articles protecting private individuals were concerned, capital punishment was abolished to commemorate the 10th anniversary of the revolution. And for the 15th anniversary, the law of 7/8 was added to the roster of capital punishment, that law so vitally important to advancing socialism, which guaranteed the Soviet subject a bullet for each crumb stolen from the state's table. As always happens at the start, they hurried to apply this law in 1932 to 1933 and shot people with special ferocity. In this time of peace, in December 1932, while Kirov was still alive, at one time 265 condemned prisoners were awaiting execution in Leningrad's Kresty prison alone. Testimony of B, who brought food to the cells of the prisoners condemned to be shot. And during the whole year, it would certainly seem that more than 1,000 were shot in Kresty alone. And what kind of evildoers were these condemned men? Where did so many plotters and troublemakers come from? Among them, for example, were 6 collective farmers from nearby Tsarskoye Selo, who were guilty of the following crime. After they had finished mowing the collective farm with their own hands, they had gone back and mowed a second time along the hummocks to get a little hay for their own cows. The All-Russian Central Executive Committee refused to pardon all 6 of these peasants, and the sentence of execution was carried out. What cruel and evil Saltychika, what utterly repulsive and infamous serf owner would have killed 6 peasants for their miserable little clippings of hay? If one had dared to beat them with birch switches even once, we would know about it and read about it in school and curse that name. What isn't known in our schools is the fact that Saltychika, by a verdict of her own peers, was imprisoned for 11 years in the subterranean crypt of the Ivanovsky Monastery in Moscow for the atrocities inflicted on her serfs. But now, heave the corpses into the water, and pretty soon the surface is all smooth again and no one's the wiser. And one must cherish the hope that some day documents will confirm the report of my witness, who is still alive. Even if Stalin had killed no others, I believe he deserved to be drawn and quartered just for the lives of those 6 Tsarskoye Selo peasants. And yet they still dare shriek at us, from Peking, from Tirana, from Tbilisi, yes, and plenty of big bellies in the Moscow suburbs are doing it too. How could you dare expose him? How could you dare disturb his great shade? Stalin belongs to the World Communist Movement. But in my opinion, all he belongs to is the criminal code. The peoples of all the world remember him as a friend, but not those on whose backs he rode, whom he slashed with his knout. However, let us return to being dispassionate and impartial once more. Of course, the All-Russian Central Executive Committee would certainly have completely abolished the supreme measure, as promised. But unfortunately what happened was that in 1936 the father and teacher completely abolished the All-Russian Central Executive Committee itself, and the Supreme Soviet that succeeded it had an 18th century ring. The supreme measure became a punishment once again, and ceased to be some kind of incomprehensible social defense. Even to the Stalinist ear, the executions of 1937 to 1938 could hardly fit into any framework of defense. What legal expert, what criminal historian, will provide us with verified statistics for those 1937 to 1938 executions? Where is that special archive we might be able to penetrate in order to read the figures? There is none. There is none, and there never will be any. Therefore, we dare report only those figures mentioned in rumors that were quite fresh in 1939 to 1940, when they were drifting around under the Butyrki arches, having emanated from the high and middle-ranking Yezhov men of the NKVD, who had been arrested and had passed through those cells not long before. And they rarely knew. The Yezhov men said that during those 2 years of 1937 and 1938, 500,000 political prisoners had been shot throughout the Soviet Union, and 480,000 blatnye, habitual thieves, in addition. The thieves were all shot under Article 59.3 because they constituted a basis of Yagoda's power, and thereby the ancient and noble companionship of thieves was pruned back. How improbable are these figures, taking into consideration that the mass executions went on not for 2 full years, but only for 1.5 years, we would have to assume, under Article 58, in other words, the politicals alone, an average of 28,000 executions per month in that period, for the whole Soviet Union. But at how many different locations were executions being carried out, A figure of 150 would be very modest. There were more, of course. In Pskov alone, the NKVD set up torture and execution chambers in the basements of many churches, in former hermits' cells. And even in 1953, tourists were still not allowed into these churches on the grounds that archives were kept there. The cobwebs hadn't been swept out for 10 years at a stretch. Those were the archives they kept there. And before beginning restoration work on these churches, they had to haul away the bones in them by the truckload. On the basis of this calculation, an average of 6 people were shot in the course of 1 day at each execution site. What's so fantastic about that? It is even an understatement. According to other sources, 1,700,000 had been shot by January the 1st, 1939. During the years of World War II, the use of capital punishment was occasionally extended for various reasons, as, for example, by the militarization of the railroads, and at times was broadened as to method, from April 1943 on, for example, with a decree on hanging. All these events delayed, to a certain extent, the promised full, final, and perpetual repeal of the death penalty. However, the patience and loyalty of our people finally earned them this reward. In May 1947, Yosif Vissarionovich inspected his new starched dickey in his mirror, liked it, and dictated to the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet the decree on the abolition of capital punishment in peacetime, replacing it with a new maximum term of 25 years. It was a good pretext for introducing the so-called quarter. But our people are ungrateful, criminal, and incapable of appreciating generosity. Therefore, after the rulers had creaked along and eked out 2.5 years without the death penalty, on January the 12th, 1950, a new decree was published that constituted an about-face. In view of petitions pouring in from the national republics, the Ukraine, from the trade unions, oh, those lovely trade unions, they always know what's needed, from peasant organizations, this was dictated by a sleepwalker. The gracious sovereign had stomped to death all peasant organizations way back in the year of the great turning point. And also from cultural leaders, now that is quite likely. Capital punishment was restored for a conglomeration of traitors of the motherland, spies and subversives, diversionists. And of course they forgot to repeal the quarter, the 25-year sentence, which remained in force. And once this return to our familiar friend, to our beheading blade, had begun, things went further with no effort at all. In 1954, for premeditated murder. In May 1961, for theft of state property and counterfeiting and terrorism in places of imprisonment. This was directed especially at prisoners who killed informers and terrorized the camp administration. In July 1961, for violating the rules governing foreign currency transactions. In February 1962, for threatening the lives of, shaking a fist at, policemen or communist vigilantes, the so-called Druzhiniki, then for rape, and immediately thereafter for bribery. But all of this is simply temporary until complete abolition. And that's how it's described today, too. And so it turns out that Russia managed longest of all without capital punishment in the reign of the Empress Elizabeth Petrovna. In our happy, blind existence, we picture condemned men as a few ill-fated, solitary individuals. We instinctively believe that we could never end up on death row, that it would take an outstanding career, if not heinous guilt, for that to happen. A great deal is still to be shaken up inside our heads for us to get the real picture. A mass of the most ordinary, average, grey people have languished in death cells for the most ordinary, everyday misdemeanors, and although some were lucky and had their death sentences commuted, which was purely a matter of chance, they very often got the super, which is what the prisoners called the supreme measure. Since they hate lofty words and manage somehow to give everything a nickname that is both crude and short. The agronomist of a district agricultural department got a death sentence for his mistaken analysis of collective farm grain. Maybe it was because his analysis wasn't what his chiefs wanted from him. That was in 1937. Melnikov, the chairman of a handicraft artel that made spools for thread, was sentenced to death because a spark from a steam engine in his artel had caused a fire. That was in 1937. True, his death sentence was commuted to a tenner. In that same Kresty prison in Leningrad in 1932, two of the men in death cells were Feldman, convicted of possessing foreign currency, and Vitelevich, a student at the conservatory, for having sold steel ribbon for pen points. Primordial commerce, the bread and butter and pastime of the Jew, had also become worthy of the death penalty. Ought we to be surprised, then, that the Ivanovo province village lad Geraska got the death penalty? In honour of the spring St. Nicholas holiday, he went off to the next village to celebrate. He drank heavily, and with a stick he hit the rear end, no, not of the policeman himself, but of the policeman's horse. True, in a rage at the police, he ripped a piece of board off the village Soviet building and then yanked out the village Soviet telephone by the cord, shouting, "Smash the devils!" Whether our destiny holds a death cell in store for us is not determined by what we have done or not done. It is determined by the turn of a great wheel and the thrust of powerful external circumstances. For example, Leningrad was under siege and blockade, and what would its highest-ranking leader, Comrade Zhdanov, think if there were no executions among the cases in Leningrad state security during such difficult times? He would think the organs were lying down on the job, would he not? Were there not big underground plots directed from outside by the Germans to be discovered? Why were such plots discovered under Stalin in 1919 and not under Zhdanov in 1942? No sooner ordered than done. Several ramified plots were discovered. You were asleep in your unheated Leningrad room, and the sharp claws of the Black Hand were already hovering over you. And yet, none of this depended on you. Notice was taken of a Lieutenant General Ignatovsky, whose windows looked out on the Neva. He had pulled out a white handkerchief to blow his nose. Aha! A signal! Furthermore, because Ignatovsky was an engineer, he liked to talk about machinery with the sailors. And that clinched it. Ignatovsky was arrested. The time for reckoning came. Come on now, name 40 members of your organization. He named them. And so, if you happen to be an usher at the Alexandrinsky Theatre, your chances of being named as one of his particular 40 were minimal. But if you were a professor at the Technological Institute, there you were, on that list. Once more, that accursed intelligentsia. So how could it depend on you? To be on such a list amounted to execution for each one. And so they shot all of them. But here is how Konstantin Ivanovich Strakovich, a very important Russian scientist in hydrodynamics, remained alive. Some even higher bigwigs in state security were dissatisfied because the list was too small and not enough people were being shot. Therefore, Strakovich was selected as a suitable center for uncovering a new organization. He was summoned by Captain Altshuler. What's this all about? Did you rush to confess everything so that you'd get shot and thereby conceal the underground government? What was your role in it? Thus, Strakovich found himself in a new round of interrogations while he remained on death row. He proposed that they consider him the underground Minister of Education. He wanted to get it over with as soon as possible. But that wasn't good enough for Altshuler. The interrogation continued, and by this time Ignatovsky's group was being executed. During one of the interrogation sessions, Strakovich got angry. It wasn't that he wanted to live, but that he was tired of dying, and more than anything else, the lies made him sick. And so, while he was being cross-questioned in the presence of some security police bigwig, he pounded on the table, "You are the ones who ought to be shot. I am not going to lie any longer. I take back all my testimony." And his outburst helped. Not only did they stop interrogating him, but they forgot about him in his death cell for a long time. In all probability, an outburst of desperation in the midst of general submissiveness will always help. Thus, many were shot. Thousands at first, then hundreds of thousands. We divide, we multiply, we sigh, we curse. But still and all, these are just numbers. They overwhelm the mind and then are easily forgotten. And if some day the relatives of those who had been shot were to send one publisher photographs of their executed kin, and an album of those photographs were to be published in several volumes, then just by leafing through them and looking into the extinguished eyes, we would learn much that would be valuable for the rest of our lives. Such reading, almost without words, would leave a deep mark on our hearts for all eternity. In one household I am familiar with, where some former Zecs live, the following ceremony takes place. On March the 5th, the day of the death of the head murderer, they spread out on the table all the photographs of those who were shot and those who died in camps that they have been able to collect, several dozens of them. And throughout the day, solemnity reigns in the apartment, somewhat like that of a church, somewhat like that of a museum. There is funeral music. Friends come to visit,